bought us so right. Are you feeling it? So loud, and it's so wide. Till we're both drunk, then it's so fast, then it's all over. Go home, go sleep, wake up, get sober. What a great night. And it's so loud, and it's so wide. Till we're both drunk, then it's so fast, then it's all over. Go home.
So we're pretty much ready to go.
I've got 4 minutes 58, but I guess we'll figure that out in
that's your job to deal with that.
So I missed the whole new Who.
Oh, you weren't up at 4 o'clock in the morning in order to see the big news?
No, I didn't.
I was.
Did you line up outside the ABC? Like, did you pitch a tent?
No. He was pitching a tent. He always pitches a tent when Doctor Who's on.
It's just Spencer then.
Yes.
Spencer was tweeting. He's put a little camp bed outside the ABC and he was tweeting, waiting for the announcement.
It was pretty fun. It's sort of nice. It's nice for me anyway that a TV show I've always loved, even as a kid, has now reached such sort of global proportions, at least sort of British colonial proportions and ex-fighting colonies, I suppose.
The sun never sets on Doctor Who.
Yeah, and so now it's something that they decide, the BBC goes, we really need to get the message out, and we have to do a 30-minute show where we reveal the next Doctor, and we have to simulcast it around the world. Yeah, they made a whole 30-minute show with, and they had old doctors come on and talk about it, and old companions, and random comedians for no reason.
How are those old doctors able to free up their schedule?
Did they have a host? Like, what was I don't even. I mean, I knew.
Yeah, they had a host. I don't know who she was. They had some blonde robot woman, and she not literally a robot, but I don't know. Maybe if you're British, you know who she is, but I'd never heard of her before. She wasn't like part of Doctor Who. She was just a host.
And, she was hosting?
Yeah. That's why. Yeah, okay. She was sort of
so
blonde.
So she's just some anonymous TV hottie that they.
Yes.
They got. They should have got.
They just took her out of the vat. And propped up in front of a microphone.
Okay, and so half an hour. It sounds like it actually sounds like a the finale of one of those wretched fucking talent shows where they just kept stretching it. Was it a decent half hour's TV, or would you be better off waiting and coming in at the 25th minute?
Yeah, no. To be honest, yeah, you don't want to be there. If you knew about Doctor Who, it's kind of one of those points. If you know about Doctor Who, then you know all the stuff they're saying. You know he regenerates. You know who he is. You know how long the show's been around. You're not going to be surprised at any point. So really, yes, you were just waiting for the last bit. I was actually surprised that it only was 30 minutes of drawing it out. That was quite surprising to me.
It was 30 minutes. The 30 minutes was the sort of the climax, shall we say, of quite a bit of quivering media tumescence on this issue over the past couple of months, because it's even been discussed, as you said, like, that there's been august American journals like Slate.com, which have run articles on, why the next doctor should be, African-American.
A man of colour,
a thing.
Yeah, or a woman.
And this has been going on for, I suppose it's been going on since Matt Smith pulled the plug, which is, a couple of months ago?
Yeah, like January, 64 days ago.
Yeah. Was that it? I thought he said in January he was going. Oh, that's right.
Okay, so it's like it's 64 days and half an hour.
Yeah, the only reason I know that is because somehow I managed to log into an old Twitter account where the last thing that was said was Greg tweeting, "Oh my God, Matt Smith has quit Doctor Who."
That's really fucking spooky when you do that, isn't it? Yeah. I did that. I had Twitter, like the Twitter app, like Twitterific or some shit, and just assimilated them like the Borg. So I had that second app as like the app that I sort of went into my private account until I figured out, Tweetbot, you can just set different accounts. Anyway, I opened it up recently because I had to use Stealth Burmo for a secret mission. And Stealth Burmo being my private Twitter account. I think it's got 34 followers, and I follow 34 people. Something like that. It's 43.
I was hoping, Burmo, that you were about to say Stealth Burmo has more people following him than Dan does. I thought that would be a really fun one.
No, that, no, would, that, would, that would actually just undermine the whole point of Stealth Burmo. Stealth Burmo was stealthy.
Yeah. And God forbid he get a blue tick on Stealth Burmo.
No, that would destroy me. But, no, well, I just, I opened this up and I think, the preview, I hadn't opened it up for nearly a year, so I opened it up and I think it was like Dr. Yobbo talking about beer and cars. I just thought, wow, it's like that's probably the last time he's mentioned beer and cars. So, yeah, you get that weird... yeah, you should do it. Like, if you're listening at home, children, get yourself an app, a Twitter app, and sort of, open it up and then just close it for a year. And
it's like a time capsule.
Like, it's like time travel when you open it up again. Mm. And the tweets have this weird sort of, almost exotic air to them. It's like you're looking into real time, but, you've sort of... warped the fields or something, and you're looking in a real time 8-9 months ago.
Crossing from from dimension to dimension, just like Jerry, what's his name, in Jerry O'Connell in Sliders.
Sliders. I loved that show.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Was that just me or?
Oh no, I was all over that one.
Oh, no, I thought it was a great show. Like, first of all, you got your multiverse thing, which immediately wins like big props from me. Well, that's it, really. That's all you needed.
Yeah, it was all self-contained stories because it was very hard to have some sort of overarching storyline when...
Until they did.
And then
they ruined it. That's when it became
that's
bad.
That's right. No, it became Monster of the Week, I think. I tell you when it fell apart was when that hot chick in the hot pants, Kari Vura, I think, she was in that movie about the big snake.
I've seen that film.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, you mean Anaconda? No, sorry, that's I haven't seen that one.
And she replaced the sort of, short-haired girl who I think was Quinn Mallory's girlfriend. Was he his girlfriend or somebody that he wanted to date?
Oh, there was an attraction. There was an unspoken tension.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah, you're right. There was a tension, wasn't there? But they'd never actually, done it. No. I never did.
You have to get the comic book and cut out the figures.
Do you remember the one where Australia was a superpower because of our awesome bonking skills?
Yes. Yes, it was the worst Australian accents I've ever heard. And because they're all women and they're all terrible Australian accents. And this woman comes in and goes, crikey, I've got the prisoners. Now I'm going to go out and do some
Your Australian accent is too good. You'd actually have to do a terrible American accent and then somehow overlay that with a terrible Australian accent. And they were all dressed like Crocodile Dundee, except like sexy Dundee in shorts and
boots. The thing that killed me is that she did that little speech and then went, okay, well, I've finished with my duties, g'day, and left.
As we all do.
Yeah.
Every time we end a conversation, we go, g'day, and we walk off.
Someone did not do their homework.
But we also, we did a thing where you declare you've offended me conversation. G'day.
Australia got the kind of the arse end with this Doctor Who revelation too, because it was released all over the world at the same time, and of course that meant 4 o'clock in the morning for us.
I reckon they did that to spite us. The same way that they just consigned... like convict ship after convict ship full of like wretches, homeless people.
Another outrage
to the far side of the world. They just figured, here's a 4 a.m. release for the Doctor Who information for you. Get that up,
I was actually really hoping that what with it being simulcast all over the world, that they'd have three different recordings and that they'd say a different person for each for Australia, the US, and the UK. And then just the forums would light up with confusion.
Dan. Maybe they did.
You actually, you stayed up, did you, Greg? You got up. Did you watch this live? You got up.
Yeah. I woke up at 4. Do count myself as a Doctor Who fan. Not so much that I want to use the term Whovian. I don't know who created this. I think it's an American, and I don't agree with it. I really don't like the term Whovian. I just go, oh, God. So I really like to be called, I am a Doctor Who enthusiast. That's fine. I am not a Whovian. That's just putting it out there. But no, I got up. I wanted to see. Because I'd actually had, I sent this to Dan. I put it on Twitter, and I was wrong. I thought it wasn't going to be Peter Capaldi. I thought it was going to be Andrew Scott, the guy who played Moriarty in Sherlock, in Stephen Moffat's Sherlock. I just thought that would be a really good fit. Like, he's a friend of Moffat's, he's worked with Moffat, he's kind of creepy looking, and he's older. He's 36 older, not as old as Capaldi, but still older than Matt Smith. But it wasn't to be. It was Peter Capaldi, which is cool.
So how long do you reckon, I mean, it's probably happened already, but how long do you reckon it should be before the first pushback against Capaldi comes from the sort of... well, let's just get all News Limited and say, you know, the sort of the righteous PC regiments who wanted the African American lesbian as the new Doctor.
I don't think there'll be much pushback.
Not from those guys.
No,
but
no.
I tell you what, already, the 16-year-old girl market is not happy that the Doctor is not really a cutie. I saw this wonderful YouTube footage of this girl waiting, video going, oh, who's going to be, who's going to be? It's Peter Capaldi. She's like, what the fuck? He's fucking ugly and old. Yeah. That's it. I'm done. I'm not watching Doctor Who anymore.
And there's quite a few. He looks like the guy who organises security for Justin Bieber. he's not even Beaver's security. He's just their supervisor.
I think there has been definitely, as Dan said, there's been pushback on that one. And lots of interesting tweets like, I never realised I was shallow until I realised I was watching Doctor Who because they're cute. And I was like, oh, well, that's, you know, that's good. That's fine. I can deal with that too. That's all right. We can... Well, you know, thanks for...
The last time we discussed Who, it wasn't here. It was when we were... over at the ABC. I think you were talking about David Tennant and how he had... like pulled in this whole new, not just generation, but like a whole new demographic of basically
women.
Non-geeky. Yeah, let's just okay. You said it. You put it out there. Yes,
girls.
A lot of girls started watching Doctor Who because of David Tennant.
Yes,
and then they hung around for Matt Smith. Do you reckon they're going to go? Do you reckon they'll...
I think there was
really
definitely die-off.
They just there for the hot Who totty?
I hope not. I hope they do stay. There was a die-off from Matt Smith as well, because Matt Smith wasn't as classically good-looking as David Tennant.
I call them Hooters, John. Hooters.
Ah. Oh, no.
I don't call them that. They kill me.
It's too late. It's out there, and it's good that it's out there because it's gonna. It's like that angry mob that was chasing me for my remarks about men being the natural victims of childbirth at the end of last week's show. They're coming after you now.
Caltrops. Spread these behind you, and I will.
He doesn't run very quickly either.
I don't think people... There's a lot of people, reading going, hey, we would have liked it to have been a non-white guy and not a guy. That would be nice too. But now that it's not, at least it's Peter Capaldi. That seems to be the take on it.
Do you reckon there'd be, more pushback if he hadn't done the Malcolm Tucker role?
Well, that's sort of what... I think it's what made him very, very famous in a lot of people's eyes, in Britain anyway. That's sort of a defining role for him. But he's one of those actors, once again, even without that role, you'd go, oh, I know him, I know him.
Yeah. He's the guy from Doctor Who.
Yeah, you're exactly right. He is the kind of guy... He's of an age, and he's got that slightly gnarly look about him... that he could play a doctor from the late 60s or the early 70s. He doesn't have the foppishness of Pertwee, but he's got that same sort of, pushed-in face that... actually, was it Patrick Troughton? Is that how you pronounce his name previously?
Troughton.
He was not a pretty man. Yet he brought a certain something to the doctor... Which is
the only good-looking one in the old seasons? Really, was Five was Peter Davidson. That was really the only guy you'd say,
and he was very. It's interesting, isn't it? And they're not just good-looking, but he was boyish.
Yes, and he was athletic, and everything they want a doctor to be nowadays.
I mean, that's not really.
Cricket,
well,
true.
He wore a cricket jumper. That's
yeah.
This is England in the the early 80s. You know, it's, I think that's all they had going for them sports-wise.
And now,
Mike Brearley could have been a good doctor. Like, he could have actually just stepped off the field from Lords, where he'd scored, you know, 18 or 19, and just gone into the TARDIS, and he could have been the doctor for sure. And, you know, he'd have been, like, humming classical music as he rewired a Dalek to fight the other Daleks, and he would have been able to give all sorts of really interesting lectures, because he's the kind of guy that could have been the doctor. And, you know, I'm just going to call him Malcolm Tucker. He comes out of, he's like much swearier, obviously, but he comes out of that same school where, you know, the doctor is a sort of reliable older English. Do you know who the doctor is? He's the guy who took Audrey Hepburn and turned her from a foul-mouthed street grub into a lady. That's who the doctor is. That's, you know, he didn't, like, you know, Rex Harrison didn't have a sonic screwdriver to do that. But if you'd given Rex Harrison a sonic screwdriver, he would have fucking, he would have tuned her up in, like, 25 minutes less than it took in the movie.
It's true. You know, the actor in an alternative dimension, a doctor we would have got was, what was his name again? Oh, I've forgotten his name. Richard Griffiths. From Pie in the Sky. You've heard of Richard Griffiths before?
And, is he the big guy? I intend to have you,
even have you by burglary. Yes, from Withnail and I.
From Withnail, yeah, yeah. He was good.
Yes, yeah, and he was, the story was that after Sylvester McCoy, the seventh Doctor, if the season had continued in the 80s and 90s, that's the 90s at that point, sorry, it didn't take its 25-year hiatus, then he was to be pegged as the next Doctor. Could you imagine? He was quite a portly fellow at that time.
Oh, yeah.
And he was
sure.
Old and bearded and fat. And you go, that would have been awesome.
Like, it would have been, yeah. Like, the only thing that would have been awesomer would if the producers took up my brilliant suggestion. I thought that Tyrion Lannister should be the doctor.
Oh, a Tywin Lannister, or Tyrion.
The Dinklage, yeah.
Oh.
The Dink. He would have been great.
Yeah, a lot of running there. Like, twice as much running as usual.
They could have got K-9 out.
Oh, and, God. Careful.
Careful. Be good.
Well,
I'm actually much more excited by the idea of Tywin Lannister, Charles Dance, being the Doctor. He would be a terrifying Doctor, just withering stares at aliens until they piss off quietly into the night. They're just like, we're going to destroy your planet. Doctor stares for 10 minutes. Everyone soils themselves and leaves. It's just, Charles Dance is just awesome.
I was wondering, I didn't get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I was wondering how long I could go without discovering who the new Doctor
hang on,
was.
Hang on, let's guess. I want to guess this, Dan. I want to guess. Let's see. So how long you could wait without learning who the Doctor was?
Like, I wasn't going to intentionally look for it.
What he's saying is how long he could go before he took the information in by
accident,
like, osmosis.
Yes.
All right. Okay. Now, are you going to use the internet? Are you going to use the internet normally, as we normally do, or are you going to try not to use the internet?
I'm going to try not to use the internet.
Okay. I would say by lunchtime. If you woke up in the morning, lunchtime, you would have found out. How's that? Like 4 or 5 hours.
I made it 4 seconds. I woke up. I opened my eyes. I checked the time on my phone, and I had a notification going, Peter, what's his name? And I was like, Capelli. That's it.
I thought you were going to say something like, I woke up, and there was Spencer Howson shaking me awake. It's Malcolm Tucker!
Oddly enough, I did wake up from a dream where that was happening, so...
My claim to fame was Spencer Howson said, oh, I need a Brisbane expert on Doctor Who. I'll give Greg a call. So at 5:10, I get a breathless and excited Spencer Howson going, how do you feel about the whole situation? And I sort of go, yeah, it's pretty good. Like, and he's like, I realize he really wanted to interview himself about how excited he was. But that's just not cool. So we're bouncing off. I was just there to go, yes, Spencer, you are excited. That's very good. And he was like, woo-hoo-hoo. So that was nice. It's nice to be wanted.
We should have We should have got him on tonight. I wonder if he'd have come on. I reckon he would have if you just, you know, you just, all you had to do is lay a little biscuit trail, you know, just a little Doctor Who here, like, you know.
TARDIS crumbs.
A little TARDIS there, like, maybe just take him through a little Dalek trail and bam, you've got him in your podcast. And he's just, and then of course you'd have the problem, you'd never get rid of him because he'd just be all Who all the time.
I think he changed the whole nature of the podcast. He's so glisteningly nice and upbeat.
He is, isn't he? I'd feel bad about swearing.
He's like that normally. Like when you hang around him and just chat to him, you kind of go, "Oh, now we'll get the dirt," and then you're like, "Oh no, he's kind of the same."
He's exactly the same. Yeah. Like,
and the weird thing is, that every 55 minutes, he gives me traffic updates. That's weird.
I love the idea that the people listening into this right now are going, who the hell are they talking about? Because he's famous in Brisbane, but he's not really famous outside of Brisbane at all.
He's big in Brisbane.
He's big in Brisbane. He's very huge. Medium-sized fish in a very tiny pond, in the nicest possible way. He is the king of Brisbane breakfast radio. We have to give him credit for that.
No, he owns it, mate. And the funny thing is, like, he's, you know, ABC often does that. They often own radio because, you know, people want to listen in the morning and get information and not this crap. Just the torrent of fucking awful that comes out of the commercial state. God, they're fucking awful. I can't stand them. You know you're going to get Spencer. You know you're going to get lots of news updates. You're going to get your traffic. And you know if you can answer the obscure question about, you know, some shitty thing that really means nothing to anybody, you're going to get a Spencer as a prize. The thing is, other ABC breakfast guys have sort of leapt from that platform into commercial radio, looking for the big bucks, and just sunk without a trace. I believe a Spencer that he, like, you know, he is just ABC down to the sort of nanometer level.
They don't use metric at the ABC. They're still on imperial.
Nano-inch.
Nano-fathom.
It's like 1/128,000th of an inch.
Is that like a real number? Did you just make that number up, or did you pull that out of your nerdy brain?
Well, a nano fathom.
A nano, like the inch, whatever it was.
I 128 is a good number because it's 111111 in binary.
Yeah.
No, I'm a nerd. that's using binary.
And also, a nano is 1/10⁻⁹, so it's 0.000000001. So that's, you know, just putting that out there too.
Yeah, do that. That's helping.
Yeah, you're playing catch up, Greg.
Oh, am I? Am I now?
You're desperately playing catch up. You know what you remind me of? You remind me of Frank Sinatra at the end of Von Ryan's Express, running after the train, reaching, and not making it.
Fine.
A lot of things we do remind me of that, actually.
You know, I don't need to take this abuse. I'm going to go get a drink. I let you guys just keep talking amongst yourselves. I'm going to go somewhere else and be abused by strangers. Excuse me.
Well, maybe we should move on to our sponsors then.
Okay, well, we're going to do it differently this week. I'm taking my hand out of the giant pot of money that we normally have. Well, let's face it, I normally have delivered. Usually Monday afternoon, the pot comes in just full of money, sometimes full of like little jewels, and it's like a gold bar in there last week, which was great. But this week, I understand the pot turned up at your place.
I'm boarding the coattails and throwing to the wind our sponsor for this week, which is the Theatre Sports Grand Championships that are happening at the Brisbane Powerhouse.
Oh, it's a good venue.
Obviously, if you're listening to this podcast, you like chaos and nonsense. And where better to get chaos and nonsense than from Impro Theatre? Now, it's going on Eka Tuesday, which is this Tuesday, if you're listening to the podcast when it comes out.
As opposed to people who've come back in time.
I know that night because I got a friend coming up from Sydney who wanted to catch up that night. So.
Well, the best place to catch up with friends is the Theatre Sports Grand Championships at the Brisbane Powerhouse.
It is pretty good. That's actually my fave venue in the whole fucking city.
Like it's a nice one, isn't it?
A few gigs there, and every single one of them has been awesome. And in fact, it had nothing to do with me. It's just I think they killed some goats or something when they were building it, and you know, they got into a little black ritual. And anyway, so they paid for this mojo with someone's immortal soul. But the bottom line is, you never ever see a bad show at the Powerhouse Museum.
Yeah.
You give up your immortal soul by going there, but you get entertainment, and
it's worth it.
And the bar is really good, and they got that great restaurant there too. I love that restaurant, the little Italian place, Bar Alto.
What?
The Italian place,
isn't that
bar. No. What is downstairs? What's down on the river?
Yeah. I was trying for jokes in the whole spirit of the comedic nature of the sponsor.
But I've only ever performed in the Vizzy downstairs. But this Grand Championship's happening in the main theatre, which is pretty keen.
The big one, a good one. If a punter was, you know, intrigued enough, a little excited in the pantstall region about this whole prospect of going to the Improv Championships, what would they do about that?
Other than
just sitting around thinking, oh, fuck, I'd really like to go to that. If they wanted to take action to make something happen, to deliver themselves into the comedy fucking cornucopia that will be served up on that night, what specific fucking steps would they need to take?
No, I'm not sure what you're asking,
just,
John.
Could you tell us what they need to fucking do?
They can go...
BrisbanePowerhouse.org.
Yeah, or go to impromafia.com and click the great big button that says book now.
Yep.
Oh, that's
easy
pretty simple
that.
Then, isn't it?
Very simple.
And it's only... Tickets are only $30, which for the Powerhouse main venue is super cheap. So my advice, get onto it.
Eka Tuesday, 7:30 p.m, Powerhouse.
And you know what that means? You're missing the lead.
Yeah.
It's Eka Tuesday, so the following day is a public holiday.
It sure is.
Yep.
You could have all sorts of fizzy sherbets that night.
Yeah. And you get to enjoy watching Natalie. Hello, Natalie. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
What's
Sorry,
he doing with
I
Greg?
Was just...
Has he gone out? Has he stormed outside? Is he outside?
He
like
storms
in his,
out a lot.
He's in his jammies.
Yeah, you know Mr.
Like
Darcy?
Having...
You know Mr. Darcy?
He's just at the window staring.
Yeah, he's just staring. He might go jump in a lake later and get all kind of sopping wet.
You wish.
But, I do. But, you know, this is theatre of the mind, so let's just leave it at that. But I tell you what, Dan is right. I'm actually hosting the Grands, which is a huge privilege. So I'll be trying to make with the funny. And look, I don't like to, dangle too much. But if Spartacast listeners are keen and are going to get their tickets, I will wear a low-cut top. And I'm just throwing that out there. You know, look, I don't know if that's setting the cause of feminism back, but I'm comfortable with my decision because I want to sell tickets.
And for the ladies, there's a fairly good chance I'm going to end up with my pants around my ankles at some point. Just statistically.
See, this is where you go wrong, Dan, because we want people to come along, not be turned off.
Oh.
You know, far be it for me to cast aspersions on your skinny legs.
Well, I'll put my pants back on. Yep, something for everyone. If you don't like the chaos and excitement of live theatre and you want something really tightly wound together, like something beautifully woven together seamlessly, then you could watch any number of blockbuster films that come out that are all pretty much identical.
And this is why... this is it. Okay, this is... For those wondering what happened to Greg, other than storming off in a huff because, you know, he just had enough, we actually wanted Ms. Bahinsky in tonight to discuss the... what would you call it? It's the commodification of narrative, I reckon, in blockbuster.
It's the cheat sheet, yes. So I found this article on Slate a couple of weeks ago that I thought that might suit the Spartacast milieu, and it concerns a book called Save the Cat, which came out in 2005. And it was written by a screenwriter named Blake Snyder. Now, he became a bit of a screenplay guru, a screenwriting guru. And so he distilled all of his knowledge into this book, Save the Cat. And basically what it is a formula, a page-by-page, blow-by-blow account of how to write a blockbuster movie. And basically this Slate article written by, let me just see this, Peter Sudeman, is theorizing that it's because this book got published, it changed the game in Hollywood and it made virtually all the movies that we see the same, because Snyder outlined 15 specific beats, actually said, this should happen on this page, this should happen on this page, you have to have this kind of event on this page. So he essentially laid out, almost mathematically, what should happen in a film.
And that's right, and it is really specific advice, isn't it? Like, if you look at sort of screenwriting advice before the Snyder book, it's all stuff, well, you know, you need your three acts, and, you know, they need to go on the journey, yada, 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 and it's actually not that helpful. This guy has, he has provided an actual blueprint, like, with specifications right down to each little nut and bolt of, like, you know, story as to what you've got to do. Like, one that stuck in my mind was that, like, I don't know, 6.5 minutes in or something, your hero has to be told off by a respected older figure that they really, you know, admire.
It's like Mad Libs. It's like they just get like a 120-page Mad Lib book and they just fill in what the monsters are and who the bad guys are and the good guys are.
It's interesting because it, like a lot of, a lot of the blame for the blockbusterization of Hollywood gets laid at the feet of Spielberg, and particularly Jaws, which was the first ever summer blockbusters. I got vague memories of it as a kid. Like, I didn't go see it because it was too scary, and, you know, my parents didn't see that kind of crap anyway. But I do have this memory of it as a sort of mass cultural event of almost like crushing weight. Like, it went into the theatres and it was there forever. And in fact, in those days, films did. Like, back in the 70s, a film would go into a theatre and if you didn't catch it the first or second week, it didn't matter. You could go back 28, 29 weeks later on, it would still be there. Mm. And, you know, just you and, you know, some guy in an overcoat a couple of rows over might be watching it. But, you know, there were much
fewer. And then it would
releases.
Go to drive-in.
Yeah, that's right. And that's right, because there was no DVD market, there was no torrents, there was theatrical release and drive-ins, and maybe 2 or 3 years later on, you'd have the big fanfare of, you know, the Sunday night movie
the premiere release on the telly.
It was huge. It was like, that was a big event in your week, 8:30, and it was 8:30. They didn't jerk you around the way they do nowadays with their, you know, confusing jerking around starting and stopping times.
Well, watch 23 minutes of Factor X.
God, they meant it. And, you know, Spielberg came out with Jaws and wrecked all that. But in fact, he didn't. There was a piece, I think I sent it to you, it was that New York Times piece, If Jaws Was Made Today. And they were effectively, I don't think they even realised it, but they were applying the Blake Snyder formula to it. And it was a very, very different movie. Like, lots more explosions, the sharks were a lot more combustible in this one. They often came with lasers, there were ninjas. Sexy female scientists abounded.
Mm. That's the best thing for a sexy scientist to do.
Some things are obviously progress, you know, sexy female scientists. Nicole Kidman in Days of Thunder as the sexy brain surgeon is one example.
Oh, but replacing Richard Dreyfuss? Come on, that's hardly... I mean, that guy fill out a pair of corduroys.
I'm going to come back to Richard Dreyfuss because I was worried about him the other day. I haven't seen him for years. I don't know what happened to him.
Yeah, he's still around. Like, wasn't he in something not too long ago? I can't remember. Or a TV show or something?
A coffin,
he's probably doing, you know, probably doing impro somewhere, I guess. But
he was huge.
He was like a huge, hairy 70s actor, and then he was just not around anymore. That happens to most actors, doesn't it? They sort of, you know, they will have their time in the sun, and it can be, you know, fantastic time, and they can do like 3 or 4, even 5 movies in a row that are very, very big, and then the next thing you see them, they're on these fucking straight-to-video stinkers that make no sense whatsoever. You think, how did that happen? There must actually be some process by which you go from, you know, being the king of the world to, you know, being in Sharknado.
Audiobooks. That's what Richard Dreyfuss is doing now. He's narrating audiobooks.
I'll bet that pays, though.
I just brought up his Wikipedia page and a couple of interesting tidbits. He was in Stephen Fry's documentary about The Secret Life of the Manic Depressive, in which he was talking about having bipolar disorder. In 2008, he sued his father and his uncle over a 24-year-old loan that he claimed was never unpaid. So he's had some family troubles. He got married again in 2006 and in 2011 was made a Master Mason by the Grand Master of Masons of the District of Columbia in Washington, D.C.
Now he can build a bigger boat.
Maybe he's keeping busy.
Come on! Come on, we're talking about fucking Jaws! That gag was gold! Fuck you all.
You can see Dan at the Impro Championships at the Powerhouse.
Yeah, and you can also see Axis of Awesome, I should point out, are coming, and they're playing at our Grand Championships. They're the team representing New South Wales. You know, the cool YouTube song dudes? They will be there. But, sorry, Greg just pointed out to me that Richard Dreyfuss, has something that John Birmingham covets.
Oh, no.
He has a blue stick.
Tell me. Oh, for fuck's sake.
So there you I think you'll need a bigger Twitter profile.
Like this, maybe, I think they just gave him that because he's got depression. I think that's the only reason they gave him that blue tick was because, you know, the man's got an illness and, you know, he was doing what they could.
So he's beyond blue tick.
Yeah, okay. I'll give him that one, I guess.
And your letters of objection.
You love
can
that
be
one, but not the
John
Jaws
Birmingham.
One? Come on.
Oh, we're going to need a bigger podcast for that level of humour. No?
Did you just do my joke? Get back at me. Fuck you.
Yeah, but I did it with style. Anyway, before we were talking about Jaws.
Yeah.
And we're talking about Hollywood movies. And the cat. Now, the thing with this is there are a lot of these kind of films that are sort of class that this Slate article has kind of put into this Save the Cat model. Things like Fast and the Furious 6, 21 Jump Street, Oblivion, the latest Tom Cruise one, they all kind of fall into these.
Have you got it there? Have you got the article hanging around?
I have it up here, yeah.
You could take us through the beats. First of all, you probably need to explain what a beat is.
Essentially, they're just pivotal events that need to happen at certain points. And it's not just about here. He's actually, because a movie script is, what does it say here? It's about 90 minutes all up. And it's a page of a screenplay is about a minute of film. So basically, there's an event on almost every page. And that's kind of the way that he goes through it. And you can follow this along. So he cites the Gangster Squad movie that came out earlier this year with Josh Brolin and Emma Stone, the guy,
all the ladies like. That guy.
Ryan Gosling?
Who's that guy? Yeah, him. He's never been in anything. He's huge, but
I don't get the Ryan Gosling. All the women love him because apparently he's really sensitive and like pro women and stuff, which is good. But I've not really seen him in many films. No, apparently he's in a really incredibly violent movie that's out at the moment, where he just goes and like fucks everyone's shit up, and it's been kind of alternately
like in praised an awesome to way, him. Like Jason Statham would. Has he got moves?
I don't know.
Because I watched Jason Statham last night. I was watching, I think it was called Safe or something. And Jason Statham, like, he was this cop who's like an undercover cop, and he'd been betrayed. And, like.
Really?
So he took, yeah.
By, like, someone who used to be a friend.
Betrayed him, and then.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Did he have a family member, like, for example, a wife or a child?
Yes.
Either taken from him through death or through kidnapping or something like that?
Both. He had both those things. So he's like an undercover cop who has been betrayed by the bad undercover cops, and that was okay. He could live with that. He became a cage fighter because he was so awesome. And he was living in this apartment with his wife, who was not, like, the prettiest girl in the room, except, you know, I guess if she was there by herself, then she would have been. But, you know, he loved her because she made him smile. And then these guys who may or may not have been connected to the guys who betrayed him. but anyway, they killed her. They totally killed her.
No. And
yes.
Obviously, he just didn't take this lying down.
Well, in fact, not in the long run. Like, initially, he was so, like, upset that they killed him. He didn't even take revenge. He just got down on his knees and waited for them to kill him too. Because I guess at that point he was channeling Ryan Gosling, because that's what I would expect Ryan Gosling to do. Mm. He accepts things, and, you know, his chick was dead, and so, yeah, he wanted to die as well. Wait, I think that's why.
The Gosling's chick was dead. I'm getting very confused with the fact.
Jason Statham's wife was killed by these dudes. Anyway, so then he becomes a cage fighter, and he's really good at it because, like, he's awesome. And then the dudes kidnap this Chinese girl who's, like, little, but she's, like, a maths genius. And she could
and
tell
they need
you exactly.
Her for something?
Yeah, they do. Like, she's a maths genius, and she figures shit out, like safe combinations and you know,
and
what's going to happen on the
black. And perhaps she saw something that she wasn't meant to see.
Something. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. At that point, no one was getting their head punched in, so I went and got a cup of tea or something.
Well, can I read you?
She knew something. She knew there's this the combination of this safe that had, like, the top bad guy's stuff in it. And so everybody is after the top bad guy stuff. And Jason Statham finds a reason to live by protecting this Chinese girl. Anyway, the thing is, he had great moves in this film. Like, he was just smashing dudes. And I find it hard to believe that Ryan Gosling would have those kind of moves.
So has John just described a traditional film, Nat? Are those the beats?
He's pretty much getting a lot of them. So there's these things where... Well, first of all, let me read you the description or a description that I found of Ryan Gosling's movie, this one that's been either loved or hated. It's called Only God Forgives. And I think John will probably be... His interest might be piqued by that title. But here's a brief synopsis. He plays Julian, a drug smuggler who operates out of a Thai boxing club in Bangkok. After his brother is murdered for raping and killing an underage prostitute, Julian is ordered by his crime lord mother, Crystal, played by Kristen Scott Thomas, to seek bloody revenge on the killer. So he is a drug smuggler. His brother rapes and murders an underage prostitute. And so his crime boss mother orders him to seek revenge on his brother's killer.
PG, some coarse language.
So apparently it's incredibly violent, this film. So if you are a Jason Statham fan, it probably won't be at that level, but it might be something to tide you over until his next straight-to-DVD release comes out. So here's some of the beats. I'm trying to work out, because he hasn't really done them in order in this article, but they have good names. So, for example...
Oh, I've got them in order here.
You've got them in order?
Yeah, yeah.
So you start with an opening image.
Yes, you do.
Yep.
A visual that represents the struggle and tone of the story.
Cool. And then you move on to...
What's an example of that? Like, I gave up on writing a screenplay a while ago because it was just too hard. Like, I didn't even know what a beat was, for one thing. No one told me. So
you needed this book, JB. This is what you needed.
I totally needed this book. But, I don't even know...
Well, Pixar use it. WALL-E. WALL-E's a good one. They give you a visual that represents the struggle and tone.
And what's that? What's the visual in WALL-E?
Massive abandoned city with polluted garbage everywhere. One tiny robot doing stuff.
I wish I'd had this book 2 weeks ago. I could have finished this screenplay.
So the theme then is loneliness from WALL-E. If we take WALL-E as the example, you've got one lonely robot. At the 12-minute mark, there's a catalyst. So this is something that's going to set a train, I guess, of events in motion. So would you say, Dan, that the catalyst in WALL-E is Eve turning up?
No, she doesn't turn up for ages, does she?
But at 12 minutes, would that be about right?
Ooh,
maybe.
Well,
sure.
Roughly.
Let's say yes.
So anyway, after a catalyst, there's an act break and followed around 30 minutes in, and then a false victory. So this is where
that's where false Wally victory falls in love with
yes
Eve, and they find a plant.
And yeah, they're having fun. There is. There's an all is lost moment. There's generally a fun and games section.
And that would be like...
The montage.
A montage, yeah. Like in a martial arts film, that'd totally be a montage where, you know, you get enough images together and a dude is all of a sudden Jason Statham.
Or Optimus Prime is tippy-toeing around in Shia LaBeouf's backyard and they're making cock-sucking jokes.
They were, weren't they?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure there was a blowjob joke in there.
There was a whole bunch of them. Actually, it was either a blowjob joke or a self-abuse joke, because I remember watching it. I think I'd gone to see it by myself, and I remember thinking, oh, I'm glad I didn't bring the kids to see this, because
I saw it by myself. I remember self-abuse.
Yeah, so there's a false victory, and then there's bad guys close in, and then there's an all is lost moment where things seem done, and then there's an emotionally charged dark night of the soul moment. What I found interesting about this is some films like your kind of trashy blockbusters, I would expect this to fall into, and a lot of those, the most recent ones that you guys have been talking about on Spartacast, I haven't seen. So things like Superman, Pacific Rim, I haven't seen these films yet. But what's interesting is that films that I really like, such as The Avengers, The Dark Knight, and Skyfall, all fall into this. And Star Trek Into Darkness, if you think about the all is lost moment, that's, hang on, spoilers I should say, if people haven't seen Star Trek Into Darkness, but that's Kirk dying in the engine of the Enterprise. So when he dies, that's all is lost. And then Spock experiences the dark night of the soul. He has that emotionally charged moment where he has to, you know, recover and then boost himself up and kill the bad guy. So a lot of these major movies that get critical acclaim still follow this pattern. So it makes me wonder what the differences are between your kind of trashy Jason Statham fist fest and Skyfall, which is ostensibly amazing James Bond. Is it just the casting? Is it the budget? Is it the definition of what's an A-list movie versus a trashy...
Yeah, because Oblivion didn't do very well, did it? Was that critically acclaimed by any means?
Is anything Tom Cruise in?
Oh, that was the Tom Cruise movie. I'm so glad it was in, because I was thinking Oblivion. I was almost certain I'd seen it and then forgotten about it. But what I'd seen, in fact, was the trailer, which nowadays often means you've seen, you know, all the high points of the film.
All the good beats.
Yeah.
Well, if I can throw in a spoiler, Greg went to see Oblivion and he sent me a text saying, I saw Oblivion. It's really similar to another movie. I'm amazed they haven't sued them for ripping them off. And I just happened to text back, and I don't know, again, spoiler, but if you guys saw the movie Moon with Sam Rockwell.
No, that was a good film. It's supposed to be awesome.
Yeah, David Bowie's son, Duncan Jones, I think he goes by now, instead of Zoe Bowie.
Zoe.
He made this film, and it's Sam Rockwell alone on the moon as, like, a maintenance guy, basically. And I just guessed that, and I just wrote back saying, oh, is it Moon? And Greg wrote back going, got it in one. How did you know that? And I went, oh, I'd just seen the trailer where it's like Tom Cruise alone on planet Earth. So I just took a punt on what's a movie I've seen where there's one guy alone on a deserted, well, the moon's not a planet, but, you know, same diff.
I'm glad. Wow. It's a shame this isn't the science podcast that we do, because that is some stellar deduction, Miss Bainsky.
It could be a planet if it really wanted to be a planet.
People are always on Hollywood blockbusters for having no originality, but they're actually talking about something different. They're saying, you know, there are no new ideas, but what they're talking about is the franchises, like, you know, if there's a particular hero or set of heroes or story world that's worked once, then, you know, it will work at least 85% as well the second time out. At least 65% as well, the third time out.
Yeah, well, you need to be able to prove to the money people that this is probably going to make money, and people go and see stuff that they recognise. They don't like to take risks.
But that's the thing. That's the interesting thing, is that there's apparently, you know, because of this Snyder formula, there's nothing new at all. It probably goes back to, who was it? Was it John Campbell, the guy, the sort of philosopher? Hero's Journey. Like, all these things are hero's journeys. And I guess what Snyder has done is just said, well, you know, if the hero's going on a journey, these are the exact steps he or she must take.
There you go. So, but that's essentially, I think, where Snyder is probably drawn on and gone, well, not just you need these character traits, but you actually need plot traits. And so he's developed he's dead now. He died in 2009. So I guess he's not around to ask what does he think of his, you know, book influencing so much of Hollywood.
All is but lost. You're right. It's Dark Knight of the Soul.
If you had a formula which you knew would win you blackjack every time, you're probably more likely to stick with that than try other things.
Especially, I mean, most writers, I mean, you're a writer, John, but do you sit there with a blank page in front of you and go, ah, fuck, I don't know what to do next? If you had, like, a cheat sheet.
Yeah, no, totally. When, I think it was Greg sent through the link originally to this story, because I'm in the process of plotting out a couple of books. I'm writing them in, you know, very cinematic style, so to give them the best chance of being adapted. And I just instantly thought, fuck, I should really get this cat book, because even though, you know, I got zero interest in writing screenplays, obviously if you structured the book in such a way that it could move as quickly and painlessly as possible from book form to film form, that might make it more likely to happen. But then, you know, that would have meant I'd actually have to go and find the book and read it, and yeah, I could be fucking bothered. So I just ended up going with my own story.
Here's a question. In terms of movies that you've seen that have been adapted from books, what have been some of the, I guess, success stories versus failures? Like, for straight adaptations, I'd probably start with something like the Harry Potter series. They're pretty
they were pretty
faithful.
Good. And she insisted on having really, like, heaps of control over that series, like more than, like, kind of insane amounts of control compared to the normal level that a writer would get, which is none whatsoever.
And it's really obvious too, because those movies do not work as movies. They don't play like movies. They feel very foreign. Especially that first one feels like a whole bunch of chapters.
Does it?
I would argue that the first two movies, which were directed by Christopher Columbus, they are very much the book, like pop-up books. Mm. But if you look at Prisoner of Azkaban, which is the third, which is directed by Alphonse Cuarón, who's done something, I think he's done that George Clooney in Space movie that's coming out soon.
Yeah, yeah, that's him.
So he's got this really beautiful eye for kind of visual poetic beauty. And I would argue that that's probably the most cinematic of all of the Harry Potter films, because it comes from more of an auteur's perspective. But I don't know, what are some other movie
LA Confidential
adaptations that have...
Okay. Because LA Confidential is a difficult book. Like, it's not Elmore Leonard, it's the other guy, the devil dog of US crime fiction. What's his fucking name? James Elroy? James Elroy, James Elroy's LA Confidential is just a... Actually, all his books are really hard to read. He's got a massive and quite unbalanced fan base. They're deeply, deeply obsessed people. Good on them. But the book is hard fucking work in a way that, you know, a lot of his books are hard work. The movie is just, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours of pure entertainment. And not because it's got, like, awesome Jason Statham fight scenes in it. It could have used a few, to be truthful about the matter. but it's just, it's a lovely piece of storytelling. It sort of delivers on that promise that I think Edgar Rice Burroughs made at the start of Tarzan, which is, you know, come on this journey with me and you will forget where you are and I will transport you to another place, blah, blah, blah. And that's what they do. And Elroy himself quite happily admitted that the book was, you know, not just an amazing adaptation, but as a piece of storytelling, you know, could be regarded as superior. That happens sometimes. Not often, but it does happen.
I think... my call is for About a Boy by Nick Hornby. I think that the book is great and the diversions that the film makes are all about the climax of the film. Everything else is perfectly pitched, and then the climax of the film is a movie end, and that's very satisfying as well.
Okay.
I've neither seen nor read that
You've
book.
Never watched About a Boy. Oh, my God, it's brilliant.
Isn't that the one with Hugh Grant, like a sort of foppish English guy?
No, who doesn't that's the one?
It's
that one where Hugh Grant plays a foppish Englishman.
Yeah.
no, that was the one where it was like Hugh Grant has acting chops type thing, isn't it?
But all of them are him having... He's great. He's brilliant. Remember when he was acting really well, pretending he was felt bad about having sex with a hooker? He was so believable.
Dusty, gonna get a drink.
I'm gonna go find out what's happened to Greg. Last I saw, he was wandering around with a wooden spoon covered in some sort of red substance.
Well, at least he wasn't here tapping it on the table, so we have to edit it out later.
Oh, good point. I haven't been tapping, have I? I've had my computer, you see. I've been searching for Ryan Gosling Punch Fest movies.
So it's been a while since you brought around Girl Clumsy.
Okay. I think I get paid this week, so it's on me.
We just have to wait until the money goes through.
Yeah. So if you can just pay now, I'll pay you back.
Son of a bitch.
Fuck, it's your round, dude. It's your round!
If you're hanging at the back of the bar,
so just bounce!
Like you're banging in the back of your car.
We turn it out!
Here we'll talk with Ben.
Down six!
You have been listening to Spartacast Episode 10, Ryan Gosling's Fist Fest, with the Smart Enough to Know Better boys, Professors Dan Beeston and Gregoire, and our special guest female action hero, Natalie Bohinski from Brisbane Times. This has been a Smart Enough Bunny production. I'm JB. Thanks for your time.
Cause what I'm hearing is all shared on the lyrical tip. Nah, I ain't feeling you, kid. We gave you something to talk, but it wasn't a thing.